An associate editor here at AgriPulse, and really looking forward to our discussion today on the innovation and technology that can help boost animal productivity and address disease outbreaks. I'm excited. We have a great panel here today, and especially with all the topics in the news around this lately, it's going to be a great discussion. So begin Allison Van Eenennaam, professor of cooperative extension, animal genetics, and biotechnology at UC Davis. Jared Shriver, U.S. business lead at Zoetis. Clint Nesbitt, the Global Director of Regulatory and External Affairs at Genus PLC, and Roger Nobler, the Director of Regulatory Studies Center at George Washington University. So, when we look at this space, there's so many directions we can begin to take this discussion in the realm of animal health, sustainability, productivity. But Allison, I'd like to begin with you. You spent a bulk of your career working in this field on the technologies and production systems. So kind of give us a lay of the land of where this technology exists and the work that you've done in this space.
Sure. Well, thank you and good afternoon, everyone. I appreciate the invitation to an animal geneticist to come to this meeting. So I work in biotechnology, which is broadly defined as the application of technology to biology, which I would argue is farming. And so when we look at biotech, there's a lot of different products that we could include in that, but often that term is used in a more narrow set to address things like modern biotechnology, which is differentiated from conventional breeding, to things like genetic engineering or GMOs and genome editing. And I'm going to focus a little bit on those two today, just because they tend to be the more controversial aspects of biotech, and I think also we've got some interesting products coming along in that regard. So if we look at traditional genetic engineering, which is colloquially called GMOs, but that really doesn't have a meaning. I mean, a genetically modified organism could be a chihuahua relative to a wolf, and that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about specifically genetically engineered or sometimes called transgenic organisms, where you've introduced a trait, a useful trait like maybe insect tolerance, where you've used DNA from a different organism to the plant that you're trying to make transgenic. And really the kind of pushback on that has really blocked, for the most part, animal agriculture from adopting genetic engineering in the same way that plants have. So there's literally millions of farmers growing genetically modified or engineered plants throughout the globe, and there's really only been, I think, two food animals ever approved. And some of that pushback was this transgenic, that is the fact that the DNA came from a different species than where it was introduced. And so in the last decade or so, there's been genome editing, which is distinct from genetic engineering in that it enables a targeted alteration in the DNA, the double-stranded helix that makes up the genome of all organisms. And you can basically tweak the DNA within an organism to give it a trait of interest. So you can inactivate a gene that maybe makes an animal susceptible to disease, for example, or you can maybe bring in a characteristic from one breed, like Angus, that don't grow horns, into, for example, Holstein dairy cows that we just saw, which normally do grow horns and have to have those horns removed, and you can bring that allele from Angus into Holsteins and get naturally hornless or polled Holsteins, and so farmers don't need to dehorn anymore. So this gene editing is kind of a newer technology that's coming along and has got some really useful applications, particularly as it relates to producing disease resistance in animals. And I'll stop there because I think other panelists will have some interesting examples to show you there.
Yeah, wonderful background there, Allison. Thank you. And Clint, we'll pull you into discussion here. A lot of your work, works around this. I'd love to hear more about Genus's work developing, the PRRS-resistant pig and some of your work in dairy and beef cattle as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. Thank you for being here this afternoon. So Genus is a global animal genetics company that focuses primarily on sort of old school breeding of improved populations of beef and dairy cattle and swine. You probably know us as ABS in the United States on the beef and dairy side and PIC on the pork side. But one of the products that we're really excited about right now is that we have developed a gene-edited population of pigs that are resistant to the PRRS virus. If you're not familiar with PRRS, it's the porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome. It's a nasty flu-like disease in pig populations around the world. It makes them get very sick from flu-like symptoms, suppresses their immune system. They develop all kinds of secondary infections, high rates of pregnancy loss, and the like. Antibiotic use goes way up when you get a herd that's infected. to treat all those secondary infections. And there really are no effective vaccines or treatments. There are a few vaccines in the market, but they don't work terribly well. So it's exciting that we figured out a way to use these modern gene editing tools to develop pigs that are fully resistant to the virus. And the science behind it is really pretty exciting how it works. Essentially, in a non-edited pig, the virus will get into the pig through its respiratory system, into its bloodstream, and the virus will bind to one specific little protein inside the pig's immune system, in its white blood cells. And once that binding happens, that's sort of what triggers the infection, and the pigs start to get sick from there as the virus reproduces. But what we've done with gene editing is that we've been able to identify that specific place in the pig's protein, in its blood, that the virus would normally bind to, and use gene editing to just take out that one little piece. And so when the virus gets into the pig, it no longer binds to the pig. It's as if the virus doesn't even recognize the pig as a pig. And the pig is completely immune to the disease, just no symptoms, no infection at all. It really is just a light switch. So it's a pretty impressive technology because it really is just sort of like on and off, night and day. You have pigs that are very, very sick, and now we suddenly have pigs that are completely immune. So we've been spending the last several years working with regulators around the world, and we'll talk about the regulatory systems here a little bit today, too. But so far, we've had the governments of Colombia and Brazil okay the pigs for production in those two countries. We are still working with FDA. Fingers crossed, knock on wood, we'll have FDA regulatory approval here in the very near future, probably this year. And we're working with several other governments around the world to get those approvals lined up, Canada, Japan, Mexico, China, and others. So regulatory systems are starting to give us the okays, and we expect that we'll be able to have these in the hands of producers probably sometime in the next couple of years, depending on the timing of some of these regulatory decisions. So we're very excited about the product. It's getting close, and hopefully we'll have it in the hands of producers here pretty soon.
Jared, we'll bring you into discussion here. Another application of, the biotechnology with Zoetis bird flu vaccine that was approved last month for conditional use in chickens. So can you tell us a little bit more about your company's animal health portfolio and that vaccine and, if we'll be able to see that actually be used?
Yeah, so Zoetis, for those of you that aren't familiar, is the world's largest animal health company. We operate in about 80 countries and have a portfolio that spans across 8 major species, everything from dogs and cats to all of the major livestock species across the globe, including fish. Oftentimes I forget about fish, but we are also in the aquaculture market. So to your point, recently we were able to receive a conditionally approved vaccine for long-lived birds in poultry, specifically in chickens. It's conditionally licensed, so at this point in time, really, if that vaccine is going to be able to be administered or used, resides within the USDA and the regulatory bodies, and obviously they're collaborating with the agencies and the industries on this. So our stance is really we want to be there to support the industry. This is an exciting vaccine that we've been able to produce to help combat. It's another tool in the tool chest, if you will. But we really need to see where this is going to evolve moving forward, and if the USDA chooses to allow that vaccine, and if so, how and when we could administer that. So we're pretty excited about that.
I think each one of you have mentioned the regulatory process within your answers. Roger, bring you into the discussion here. You've had an extensive career in the public sector, private sector, and a lawyer, of course. Can you kind of detail to us some of the how challenging the regulatory environment is right now and what's needed for producers and for industry to have success getting these technologies to market and to use?
Well, Lydia, thank you, and thank you all for having me here. And In a conference on agricultural technology, a regulatory expert would seem to be, something that's not like the other. But in this day and age, you cannot look at any kind of news or have any kind of discussion, really, not just in the United States, but worldwide, without people focusing on what's going on in Washington, D.C. to alter the regulatory state. And that has really been in the 35 years of public policy that I've been involved in, both as a regulator, as a legislator working on Capitol Hill, as a committee chief counsel, and then at the railway, where I was exposed to a great deal of agricultural work. there's never been a greater time of change or more focus on regulatory matters. Now, that's the easy part, is to say everybody's paying attention to regulatory matters. Then the hard part is to turn around and say, okay, now what? How do we look at the regulatory processes, particularly for approving new technology, which is really what you'd call in the regulatory world an adjudication, where the agency makes a determination based on a specific set of facts for one, you know, for one of the parties who's submitting it. And for that, it requires expertise at the agency, it requires effective processes, it requires a desire to cooperate, and it requires the agency being willing to look at and evaluate and take risks on new technology, which have never been really regulatory strengths to begin with. And then you layer on top of that what we've seen in the last 4 months, where we've just seen an unprecedented set of disruption to the regulatory state. And on the one hand, you know, folks who have been frustrated with dealing with government might look at that and say, you know what, this is great, where the government sector is undergoing a correction, which needs to happen at times. And on the other hand, in order to effectively revise processes, to streamline them, or even to deregulate, you need people, and you need people who are effective and able to be able to understand the processes and to be able to put in lasting change, which is going to go on for longer than just the time that you're doing it. So I think we're at a challenging moment here, where even if there is consensus around the need to take deregulatory or streamlining steps, are we going to have the people, the expertise, and the ability to make lasting regulatory change? So it's a fascinating time, and hopefully we'll get to talk more about it.
Yeah, and kind of work a little bit backwards here, but Clinton, Jared, I'd kind of like your perspective on, you know, what does that regulatory process look like? You know, what's the timeline, the costs, and where are the bottlenecks for you all in the private animal health space right now?
Okay, so on the animal biotechnology side, currently here in the United States, we're regulated by FDA. FDA's regulatory structure for biotech animals is based upon their authority to regulate new animal drugs. They've made an interpretation several years ago to use that new animal drug framework to essentially treat edited DNA as if it were a drug. And so in terms of process, most of the procedural steps that we have to follow with FDA sort of mimic the process of evaluating a new drug. So in some cases that makes sense. We're looking at sort of the basic kinds of safety data that a lot of other countries around the world ask for. But in a lot of other areas, it really doesn't make sense, and we're sort of jumping through hoops that were designed for drugs, whereas this is a pig. Just to give a few examples of what this looks like, our facilities have to be regulated by FDA. They're inspected. They're overseen as if they're something analogous to a drug production facility. We have to provide labeling information with the pigs, the way you have to put a little pharmaceutical insert in the pill bottles. We have to do that with our pigs. We're subject to a DUFA, so we pay a DUFA fees the way a normal drug production company would have to pay fees, and those run in the hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. So there are certainly, I think it's fair to say, a lot of opportunities for improvement in the way that FDA oversees our products. It is probably the most cumbersome and inefficient regulatory system that we've had to work with. Somebody was asking me how long it takes. It's hard to say. I would say we first started working with USDA formally probably in the 2017-2018 timeframe to really start identifying here's what the regulatory steps are going to look like. So at a minimum, I would say it's been 7-8 years, something like that. And I'm sure there were conversations with FDA even earlier. When you compare FDA's regulatory system to the experiences that we're having in other countries around the world, it's quite a bit different. I mean, I think there's a huge spectrum of different kinds of regulatory strategies around the world. Some of the countries that are, I think, probably most progressive in this space are really looking at evaluating whether or not these animals would count as a GMO or not, given their older GMO-focused regulations. And they can just essentially decide, okay, if it's not a GMO, then we're going to treat this as if it's a conventional, you know, non-GMO and let it be free to go. So that's the system that Brazil and Colombia have been using that was so efficient for us. They basically just determined that the pigs aren't GMOs, therefore you may treat the pigs as conventional pigs in those markets. FDA is probably at the other end of the spectrum, but there are other countries kind of further down along the spectrum towards FDA, like Canada, like Japan, where it's kind of a hybrid, making a decision of jurisdiction while at the same time doing some kind of a safety assessment focusing on efficacy, feed safety, safety of the animals, and the like. So in answer to your original question, it really depends on the market. It's just very, very different and honestly idiosyncratic from country to country, where no two markets are the same.
Jared, your perspective?
Yeah, I think a great example to what Clint was talking about, if you look at current products that get manufactured in the United States, we can actually get those products approved in the European markets 12 to 18 months faster than what we can in the U.S., which is insanity. So we're developing these products, but other countries are moving faster on innovation, and that's really the name of the game, is improving the timeline on getting innovation to market. That's where we have a big risk in this industry, and if we don't continue to keep our foot on the gas, so to speak, we're going to fall behind. Not only are we going to fall behind, but we're also at risk of losing some very valuable technologies that have been out for a number of years just because of the regulatory framework that we have to operate in. So to your question on the bottleneck, really it is all around that regulatory framework. We need to make sure we're building an environment that is supporting innovation, fueling innovation, driving innovation, allowing our customers and producers to be more productive, more efficient, and to be able to operate with sustainable growth moving forward. And unfortunately, some of the regulatory guidelines we operate in today actually stifle the advancement of innovation. So it's a place we have to really lean into. It's a great time with the change in leadership in the White House administration, but we've got to get this right, and we need to lean in so that we can fuel this moving forward. If you think about the United States and the amount of impact and pressure on us to produce a safe and sustainable food supply to feed the globe, there's no way we can do that without innovation. And that's where we got to continue to drive. A great example is what we talked about earlier was on the high path avian influenza. That's a great example of where everyone came together with some urgency and demonstrated agility to get a product put and approved, conditionally approved, to the market very quickly. But we got to be more nimble in how we operate. And as far as the bottlenecks, cost, time, all the regulatory red tape that we have to go through, and we play on both the USDA and the FDA side, and it's a challenge on both sides, I'll just tell you. There's a tremendous amount of cost. Roger, you talked about the expertise. We've lost a lot of that expertise over the years, so it is an area we need to lean into, because if we can simplify, streamline, find efficiencies in this, it's going to allow us to continue to drive forward and bring the innovation we need.
And Allison, we were chatting earlier, you mentioned that you kind of got into your career because of, you know, scientists and consumer pushback to some of these technologies. So I'm wondering, during your career, how have you seen consumer perceptions change? And then a second part to that, with the Make America Healthy Again movement and the focus there on vaccines, you know, how have you seen consumer perception change on these technologies with all those factors in play?
Yeah, I actually got my job because of a guy called Jeremy Rifkin, who anyone in the dairy industry will be familiar with, who was suggesting that recombinant bovine somatotropin caused cancer. And so the university put someone in place to try to get evidence-based information out there as it relates to this technology. And I think it's and this was back in the days before Twitter. I actually started at Calgene, just to give you an age there. And it's been frustrating, I've got to say, as a science communicator, to correct incorrect information around GMOs. And so I thought we were making some headway, to be honest. And so about a decade ago, and those of you in the plant space will probably recognize some of our efforts with movies like Food Evolution and the IQ2 debate, where we actually were able to convince the New York City audience that GMOs were actually a good, safe product that would be, you know, good for sustainability. But I think, and maybe it's social media, that we're kind of going backwards a little bit now. And I think ag scientists have dealt with this for a number of years. And I think that the medical community is now kind of experiencing it and going, oh my gosh, and I'm kind of like, well, hold our beer, you know, hold my beer. We've been really trying to correct the narrative around misinformation, and the kind of the fear sells narrative is very difficult to counteract with calming, reassuring information that, no, it's safe. You know, we've got lots of studies that show that. If you suggest to a parent, oh, your kid might get autism or you might get cancer, it's hard to get that out of your head. And it's like, well, just in case, I'll buy the non-GMO butterfly product because no harm, no foul. But actually, what that does is it kind of sends this signal to developers, don't develop because we're just going to create fear around your technology so we can sell our higher-priced alternative butterfly product. And then things like RBST is basically not on the market anymore. And as a result, the sustainability of the dairy industry is, what, about 7% higher than it could have been if we could access that technology. So what if your pigs get chased out of the market? Well, now we just have sick pigs instead of pigs that couldn't have got disease. And things like disease resistance to me is just the triple win for sustainability. And that opportunity cost of not allowing safe innovation to come to market is what's missing from the public discourse around this, because there are consequences to doing nothing. And sometimes the risks that concern people and the risks that kill people are entirely different. And I think we're living that right now. And ag science has a very ugly history of ideology driving agricultural production decisions. And I think back to Lysenko, who some of you will be familiar with. He was a geneticist back in Russia that basically had a different view as to how plants viewed their competitors, didn't like Mendel, and basically changed the way that plants were growing in Russia, and it resulted in ginormous famines and killed literally millions of people. And I think the food security implications of allowing incorrect ideologies to drive production decisions is really dangerous, and we've got a long history of that, and I'm very worried at the moment, to be honest, because at the moment I do not feel like the correct information is actually driving policy, and that concerns me a lot.
And when we look at, you know, having the correct information, a big component of that is the staff, you know, doing the research. So you know, we've seen thousands of layoffs across federal agencies through the Department of Government Efficiencies, cost-cutting efforts, and Roger, you know, bringing you into the discussion here, how has the regulatory space felt the impact of those staff cuts already, and how could it further affect the timeline for approvals in the future?
Well, it's a good question. We've never seen anything like this where federal workers, particularly those who are beyond their probationary periods, are covered by civil service protections and are typically very difficult to let go. Normally, you'd have to have a function eliminated in order to do what's called a reduction in force. And I know folks will tell you, oh, there's lots of ways of letting government employees go, but having worked on shuttering an agency, I can tell you that there really aren't. So a lot of what you see is perhaps haphazard, which is we're just going to let every single person who's in the first 2 years of their new job go. It's not because that would be the most logical way to do it. It's because those are the people who have the least amount of civil service protection. And anybody who's been around a large organization, sort of cost rationalization, you typically start with the most expensive people in their job category, not the least. But that's just the way that's kind of the backwards way the federal government works. And then you've seen a lot of functions just eliminated, I think, again, because it's an easier place to go under civil service laws. Then there are layoffs and actions that are being taken that are probably not necessarily permitted, but they're trying to force a court case or force some kind of action to give more flexibility. And then there are things that are clearly not permitted, like firing a EEOC commissioner or something like that, which they're clearly trying to get judicial precedent changed and just change the law. So there's a spectrum of reasons why things are happening. But in terms of the ability of agencies to function and be effective, I mean, clearly anytime you have a reduction in force, that impacts the efficiency and the capability of an organization, no matter what it is. And then when you layer on top of that the sort of unprecedented action that's going on in Washington, it would be hard not to see that the agencies at this moment are probably a little bit paralyzed. That would be my guess, at least certainly the ones I've spoken to have, and it's a big federal government. I've only spoken to a few people. But I think in terms of some of the issues that folks were talking about in terms of approving new technology, That requires expertise. I mean, really, the more sophisticated the regulatory framework and the more nimble it is really requires more expertise, people who are comfortable and understand what they're doing and the ramifications of what they're doing. And when it comes to safety, a lot of times you get the prove the negative, right? Prove that nothing bad will ever happen, which, of course, you can't from a scientific standpoint. You can look at populations and you can say statistically, this is no worse than that or this is better than that, but you can't say individually, nothing bad will ever happen. You can't prove the negative. And if regulators want to see that before taking action, that can prove to be extraordinarily frustrating to those who are seeking approval of new technology, even if on a population-wide basis, that new technology is safer than what it's replacing. It just can be one that can be maddening on the one hand, but on the other hand, that's the way regulators can think. That's what drives regulated entities a little bit, that can drive them to drink sometimes. And I was trying to think of the right phrase, but that can make them very frustrated, let's put it that way, having been there myself. And, you know, at the same time, the kinds of actions that are being taken are not, in the short run, going to make those processes faster or more efficient. And the question is, when this all settles out, will agencies be more nimble and be more willing to take risks on new technology or less? And, you know, I think that that's an open question going forward. We will have to see.
Yeah, first, you know, Allison, I'd like to ask how those cuts have impacted your ability to do your job. And then after that, kind of give the floor to the rest of the panel of, you know, if you're concerned about brain drain at these agencies and how that could affect your work. But Allison, if you kind of want to give us an overview of how those staff cuts have impacted your ability to do your job.
Well, so most of my funding is agricultural, so I'm not NIH funded and I don't work for the USAID. I have had one grant that's been put on hold. That's a cooperative agreement with the Foreign Ag Service where we're trying to harmonize regulatory approaches for genome edited animals to allow exports of products from America to other places. I'm not sure when that will get resolved. So as every single person on this stage has said today, it's created a lot of uncertainty. People just sit there spinning their wheels waiting to kind of figure out what's going to happen. And so that's a relatively small effect that has happened to me relative to other, you know, medical researchers that have actually had their grants cancelled and that type of thing. So I think it depends a little bit on your field as to what the actual impacts are. But what that means also, NIFA, or National Institute of Food and Agriculture, USDA, Competitive Grants Program has pulled down their request for proposals, which means that future grants you can't apply for at the moment. You know, that might go up again in the future, but again, uncertainty and just, it just kind of is this spiral of what's happening. And so, you know, the thing with academic scientists is we can't make more widgets to fund the research. We're basically either writing grants or we're working with companies to fund our research. I mean, those are our two options. And so if you have an existing grant and you've got your people on board and you've got a contract and then it's just stopped, that's a really difficult thing because how do you deal with those people? And so I think it's just created a lot of uncertainty. And this particular grant, I think, is working to help American agriculture and trying to get regulatory harmony. I don't think it ticked any of the prohibitive topics. And so it's a bit hit and miss as to how it's a bit of a sledgehammer rather than a fine tooth comb, I guess.
No, go ahead, Jared.
Yeah, I was going to say, from our perspective, and it goes back to what we were talking a little bit about earlier, is around the bottlenecks and around the expertise. So if we see cutbacks there, we're already having discussions around the slow speed to market, the adoption. If we start to lose some of that institutional knowledge, that's going to just further slow things down, pull our innovation pipeline down, slow the process down all the way through. You're going to have people changing roles, lack of clarity. So there's definitely things here that we're watching for. As far as how it's impacted us today, nothing yet, but it's certainly a place we're watching very closely.
Yeah, and I would second that. Our experience has been very similar. So far, the reductions in force have not affected our product directly. Thankfully, our risk assessors are all still there and working. But the risk is, yes, we continue to watch that, because if they do start to lose key people, it could have an impact on regulatory process. And then, as you were saying, I think that you also kind of lose, you have the brain drain, so that the people who are experts in the regulatory system are no longer there to help lead change and to be sort of the innovators in whatever comes next. So I think that's one of the big concerns that we have also.
And Jared, we'll begin with you, and then if anybody wants to jump in, but there's been kind of a back and forth about whether vaccines will be used as part of USDA's strategy to combat the bird flu. I'm wondering if you can provide some context over those concerns for, you know, the trade barriers of vaccinating poultry, and then, you know, the audience is asking, you know, what can Zoetis do to move those processes forward?
Yeah, so just to make a couple points clear, the vaccines that we got approved for poultry and full transparency, we're also working on a dairy high path H5N2 vaccine as well. We've done the safety work. We've done the efficacy work. These are traditional killed vaccines. They're not mRNA. I'll just get that out there because I'm sure that question may come up later. These are traditional killed vaccines and vaccine technology, again, where we've done the safety and efficacy work. There are trade issues, and that is a place where, you know, we're certainly talking to our industry partners. We're talking with the folks on the Hill and having discussions, encouraging those open discussions. And there is a lot of discussion happening behind the scenes on trying to sort this out. And in all fairness, it's billions of dollars at stake that they're trying to work through. So it's a real situation when you look at the trade and how if one set or one population of an industry moves forward, I can shut everything down and have negative impacts all the way through. So I know it's a big task. We're certainly at the table. We want to help educate in any way we can, and that's what we're spending a lot of time doing is education around vaccine, vaccination, the safety, the efficacy, et cetera, and then really just continuing to support those agencies as they work through this so that if the USDA and the regulatory bodies decide to move forward, we want to make sure we're there to help support and our tools available to leverage at that point in time. But it's certainly a big topic and a big issue. Literally before I walked up here, I was some more news hitting the media breaking on this. So it's a daily thing that we're staying on top of.
And we have a question rolling in that anybody can answer, but, you know, could gene editing have prevented the bird flu outbreak to begin with? You know, is there technology that's capable of that right now?
There's a couple of peer-reviewed papers where specifically the Roslin Institute in Scotland have been for many years trying to make first genetically engineered chickens and more recently gene-edited chickens that are resistant to bird flu. And they had some success in actually they just switched a couple of amino acids in a protein. Those birds were less susceptible but not 100% resistant. It's a tricky disease. And so absolutely the technology could help. You have to find, obviously, the right gene, like we have in the case of PRRS. That's not always going to be there waving its hand, and it's going to require basic research. But I think that, you know, gene editing really does have the potential to address some of these disease challenges. And I think we lose like 20% of animal protein to disease globally. And so if we have a tool that can actually address that, and particularly I think when you're in the case of editing where you're not introducing transgenic DNA, it doesn't make a lot of sense to say, no, we're not going to adopt that technology, because it actually results in better farmer outcome, better animal outcome, and reduced use of drugs to treat sick animals. So it's a rare triple win for sustainability as disease resistance. And I personally have a very hard time arguing why you would rather have a disease-susceptible animal than a gene-edited disease-resistant animal.
In I guess open to all of you, but maybe Roger, what are your specific recommendations for streamlining reviews and approvals between USDA, FDA, and EPA? Just because there's so many different regulatory bodies, and if you want to defer, you know, for the specifics on that, but so many different bodies you all have to work with.
No, it's an excellent question, and one that I would say is one of the real interesting questions in streamlining, which is how do you take linear successive processes of which you have many steps, and almost any one of those steps you ultimately get through, you're ultimately successful, but the cumulative weight of trying to get through all of those steps creates a challenge and a difficulty that exceeds any individual one. So if you have 20 steps and you have a 95% chance of getting through all 20 steps, the chances of getting through all of them, however, are much lower. And then when you sort of factor on top of that the time and the ability to look at different things and the fact that any one problem in any one place, it's the only way to really reform those is to have fewer steps. And then the problem is somebody looks at them and says, okay, well, if you pick one and say, well, this one's a problem, they say, well, 90% of applicants get through this step, so what's the problem? And the problem is just the cumulative effect of going through step after step after step creates a stickiness and a difficulty and an impediment to streamlining regulatory processes that gets to be much more difficult. So the typical answer is, well, we're going to come up with a shot clock where everybody who's reviewing something only has a set amount of time. Anybody who's ever been an applicant for a process knows that doesn't really work, because what are you going to say if they haven't been able to finish? If when you're hitting the time, they could either say no, or they say, well, we haven't really finished, so we need more time. Do you agree to it? And if you're an applicant, you have no practical choice but to say yes, because otherwise they'll just make a decision that either can't stand up in court or is just going to be a no. So I've never been a believer that the process shot clock improvements really make a difference. You really need to go in and say, is there value being added in this individual step? Do a zero-based review of each individual step and then try to eliminate some. And what you find is that almost every step there was a good reason why you did it, but is the incremental value you're getting from it worth the incremental time? And that's, I think, that's a kind of a process answer to the question, which is how you have to unpack a process.
And a question from the audience coming in. What consumer acceptance research has been done for genetically engineered animals for food consumption? Allison, maybe you want to take that?
Well, so GE has been for many years used to refer to genetic engineering. I'm guessing that's gene edited. So I just say that because there's a very deliberate intent to conflate the two amongst groups opposed to the technology. And to me, they're quite different when you're not introducing transgenic DNA, because as has been alluded to by Clint, in many countries they're not being treated differently to conventionally bred animals, because actually the way we get conventionally bred animals is selecting naturally occurring genome edits that nature did. That's called selection or evolution, if you want to think of it that way. But if we look at the... I can give you an example of consumer acceptance, because there is a country that's got 3 approved products that are being consumed by their people, and that is the country of Japan. What? So there's 3 gene-edited fish that have been given non-GMO determinations that are available for consumers in Japan, and they anticipated big backlash because they were not fans of genetic engineering. And these fish were developed by a university researcher who said, hey, this is really cool. I got these fish that get to market weight in half the time. I'm going to form a little company and I'm going to sell it to the consumers. And the consumer said, awesome. And there has not been the expected pushback. And there was an attempt to try to create fear around it, and it just didn't take. The consumers were just like, no, not happening. And so I think there's often said, oh, the consumers will push back. And it's not, in my opinion, the consumers necessarily that are making that decision right off the bat. It's rather competing marketing groups who see an opportunity to create fear around that technology that then they can sell their product that doesn't contain that fearful compound and have an extra buck or, you know, put a butterfly on it or whatever. And that's where the fear comes from. And so long as that is a profitable marketing strategy for them, it's difficult to stop that narrative from getting out there. And I think it's a pretty disingenuous way to make a living, actually, to sell something that doesn't have unicorn poo, because yours has unicorn poo. And it's like, no, it's just, in this case, we're talking about a deletion. There's literally nothing there. And it makes the pigs not susceptible to disease. And if we want a sustainable food system, we want to reduce chemical use, we have to use technologies like biotechnology, and we'll have pigs that don't need to get treated when they're sick. And that's a win for everybody. I would argue that does make America healthy again. And to me, this polarization around technologies that have dramatically reduced insecticide use globally and chemical use is kind of insane, because if you look at the data, these technologies really help if that is actually what you want in the production system. And so it's not making logical sense to be opposed to technologies that reduce sickness and also chemical use.
I would just also add that we have conducted a lot of our own public opinion survey work, both here in the United States and several of the other key markets where we intend to sell the pigs eventually. And the patterns that we're seeing, and in some other published research as well, is that consumer opinion has not yet solidified against the technology in the ways that they might have against the older sort of GMO. So there isn't that negativity yet around gene editing, and at least an openness to consider things differently this time around. So there's hope that there's a space to have that dialogue where you really can talk to consumers about the benefits of the technology and like where those opinions haven't yet hardened in some sectors the way they had with the older technologies. The other thing that we're finding, too, is that consumers seem to be more willing to consider the technology if the applications of the technology align with their personal values. So if it's something that decreases or improves animal welfare, for example, or if it improves the sustainability of agricultural production, makes pigs' lives happier, those kinds of things, consumers are much more willing to consider those kinds of applications of the technology than things like sort of, you know, basic production traits and the like, you know, making more meat with less, that kind of thing, just unfortunately doesn't resonate with most consumers. So the trait itself will have a big impact, I think, on consumer acceptance. The other thing that we're learning, too, is that acceptance is very much dependent upon how you talk about the technology. You have to talk about it openly, transparently, understand how your values as a company and as a developer align with the values of the consumer, and sort of show that connectiveness and sort of like we're all trying to work towards the same goal, and we're using this particular tool to be able to get there and align with the kinds of things that are important to you as well. So I say all of that acknowledging the fact that we haven't sold any of the pigs yet. So we'll see. But I think there is hope that this conversation this time around, with a lot of transparency, a lot of openness, will hopefully go better than it did with some of the older GMO applications.
Wonderful. Well, that concludes our discussion. Thank you all for your time and for all your perspective on, you know, the regulatory processes and all the emerging technology. Excited to see all that come through and get into the hands of producers. But have you all please stay seated for a message from our sponsor, Farmer Mac.